We've been prospecting for weeks.
And still no gold.
I even brought my lucky pickaxe.
Hey, look, Donnie has a bunch of gold. Hey, Donnie, where'd you get all that gold?
Strike it rich. It's a scratch ticket from the Connecticut Lottery with a $1 million top prize.
What? It was that easy?
Oh, man, I just sharpened this thing.
Please play responsibly. Overall odds 1 in 3. Odds vary during game. Must be 18 or older to purchase. CTLottery.org.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Constitution of the United States. Why have a constitution? I look to Federalist Number 10, written by James Madison, addressed to the people of New York, and one quote resounds over the centuries since Mr. Madison wrote. There are two methods of curing the mischiefs of faction, the one by removing its causes, the other by controlling its effects. The reason he writes this is that he was anticipating factions. We would call them parties. And he's concerned, after the construction of America, the Republic of the United States, that factions can emerge in future. The factions today are obvious. We call it partisanship. So why have a constitution? Does a constitution in some fashion answer this concern of Mr. Madison's about factions? I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. He writes, he teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, and he writes at Defining Ideas about the constitution we have now and the descent from what we've inherited from our forebears. Professor, a very good evening to you. Mr. Madison was worried about something that hadn't happened yet, but it's all around us now. So why do we need a constitution? Why do we have one today? Good evening to you.
Yeah, well, this is a very tough question, but what Madison realized is that whenever you give somebody legislative power, they have a monopoly of force, and they could use that power, if they're given a complete unconstrained option to behave, to take from one group and to give to another. The most obvious form of that is outright confiscation. But even if you cut short of that, through majority rule, you could impose situations where taxes hit more heavily on one group than on another. Zoning ordinances hit more heavily on one group or another. And so there's going to be a huge transfer of wealth going back and forth. The moment you get those kinds of transfers of wealth through the political process, you reduce the incentive to create durable wealth in the economic process. And so what you're trying to do is to create a constitutional structure that will permit the economy to flourish. Now, Madison, in fact, was actually not quite sure of the way in which this ought to be done. It's generally not remembered that he thought that the solution to the faction was not in a Bill of Rights. That came later. He thought that the way in which you were to do this was to create an extended republic, and so that people drawn from high-class society would, in fact, be virtuous men and women, actually men at that time, who would take the deliberation and do it clearly. And the idea that somehow or other an extended republican will stop the problems that you get with local politics is crazy. Basically, what happened is if people have corrupt motives and it turns out there's an opportunity, they will seize it, whether it be at the local or at the national level. This was then perceived to call for the creation of a Bill of Rights on the one hand, and also for a system of complex elections on the other. So back in 1787, a Republican form of government was quite different from a Democratic form of government, because the way in which the Republican form of government tried to stop all of this stuff was to have different voting procedures, different rules, different eligibility requirements, using essentially a complicated electoral stores to protect men of property from the depredations that would otherwise happen. The one that Madison was worried about most was actually debtor's relief. You just forgive debts to a group of individuals, and it's kind of a wealth transfer. Well, it turns out that the elaborate voting systems and so forth, they work a little bit, but as Madison put the problem, he says these are permanent aggregate interests. They don't have to be a minority or a majority. They could be either. And one of the things that you have to understand is, given the way in which committee structures work and voting participation works, a majority can actually take money from the majority, a minority from the majority, if in fact you set up the rules in exactly the right position. And so the point of a constitution, when you put both its structural provisions in and its Bill of Rights provision, is to say, we can't do this. Now, the reason that the legislature can't be trusted to do this is that it will have all the particulars of cases in front of us, and those will simply run roughshod over everything else. So essentially, the frame is They did not rely on John Rawls, who, of course, lived and worked in the 20th century, but they relied on Adam Smith, who started to talk about the impartial observer, who would understand the general trends of humankind. So the theory was, if you start to put together a constitution and you do it before any particular dispute arises, you can get individuals to agree from behind this, as Rawls called it, veil of ignorance, that rules that lead to the destruction of property and the destruction of incentives to create property are bad. And so what you do is you put into place those institutions which you know are going to be durable, and you have to then have certain kinds of beliefs about permanent human nature, which they did have. You have to believe, as an economic matter, that generally competition is better than monopoly. You have to believe that taxation could become arbitrary, that confiscation is risky, that political cabals will come together. And then you try to put in a set of rules that will stop all of them. If you wait for legislation, it's too late. What happens is legislation could be very effective if the way in which people decide on legislation is going to be constrained by the way in which they're forced to deliberate and vote. So if you have a good constitution that allows you to put in public regarding projects but not outright wealth transfers, the way in which the deliberations are going to work are going to be very difficult if your constitution says, take from A and give to B. Because in the first case, you're going to have to try to get everybody to go along. And in the second case, you're going to try to get a winning faction together that will execute this particular problem. So what Madison talked about was an enduring problem. His solution in Federalist 10 was regarded, I think, by just about everybody as insufficient unto the occasion. We can do better than he did. But you have to remember, the bigger the government, the higher the amount of money that's at stake, the more pressure is going to be put on institutions. And today, the federal government has a power 100 times greater than it was then. The country is 100 times larger than it was then. And our institutions are starting to creak because the fundamental differences that we have as to how a government ought to operate have been very great. And you then see Madison's nightmare coming to bear. Major legislation passed by a 51-50 vote in the Senate. Tiny minorities in the House.
I want to contribute what I can from my reading of Andrew Roberts's wonderful new biography of George III, who was much in the minds of the founders and all the dissent at the period. The chief concern for George III, who was the first Hanoverian king to actually grow up in the United Kingdom. Previously, they were all German speakers. The major concern for George III was, I want to be a good king to all my people, and the American war must be solved because of these dissenters. So he exercised overwhelming power, the Royal Navy and the Royal Army, and could pretty much point his war machine any direction and destroy a city or destroy an army. However, the revolution led to a surprising outcome, which is a stalemate, and then George III called it off. He wanted to continue, but the parliament did not. Now, what I learned from this is the major concern at the time for everybody was what you call the aggregation of power, to prevent the aggregation of power. Mm. Now, that was in the minds of Mr. Madison. It was in the minds of all of the revolutionaries. Does the Constitution prevent an aggregation of power today, or do we need to augment it? And by that, I mean majoritarianism. Does it prevent that as well?
Well, it depends on how you read it. If you went back to the Constitution as it was interpreted up to about 1937, most of the constraints against majoritarianism pretty much held. There were limits on what the federal government could do. There were limits on what the states can do. There was a strong kind of protection for economic liberties. So if you start going back and looking at the kind of legislation that they had and the kind of constitutional interventions they had, they were remarkably good. One of the things that happened during the period, and this is a decisive period just before Roosevelt, is you had mainly classical liberals, limited government types in charge of the courts. And what they had to do is to figure out what to do. And in one sentence, they got it right. There's little errors here and there, but the basic proposition they had was they recognized and they managed to know how to operate systems of rate regulations for public utilities and common carriers that had monopoly powers, and how to work the antitrust laws in a way that would make sure that monopolies could not exist in other sectors. But they were very adamant that you could not use federal power or state power to create and perpetuate monopolies under law. And that absolutely evaporated in a stunning rapidity between 1934, when there was a case called Nebbia against New York, which allowed minimum price supports to be put into place for the sale of milk in the dairy industry in the city, to 1937, when we start to authorize cartels in labor. We authorize them in agriculture. We authorize them in transportation on the ground, authorize them in transportation in the air. The entire Roosevelt administration was essentially devoted in its peacetime years to organizing, perpetuating those cartels. That is exactly what the profound shift was. And what's so amazing about all of this, this was an intellectual movement driven by the progressives who had written in the first quarter or so of the 20th century. There was no change in constitutional text, but there was such a change in orientation that what had been at one particular point in time a solid consensus in favor of limited government became a solid consensus in favor of a large administrative state. The key intellectual figure in the United States was probably Woodrow Wilson, who wrote about this when he was just out of graduate school in a book called Congressional Government in 1885. He was 29 years old. And what our friend Wilson did is he regarded separation of powers as an inconvenient structure which prevents us experts from putting into place the common rules that we need. And no, that's exactly what the framers feared. They assumed that experts would have corrupt motives, that faction would take over. And so what happens is the Woodrow Wilson assumption was that you're going to put administrators in power and they're going to be benevolent and expert. You put the framers in situation, they said, government is a necessary evil. We have to watch these guys like hawks, and these guys turn out to be us.
We have a tripartite government and we have federalism. So when we come back, there are dissenting voices here in the 21st century that 300 million plus people in the world of globalization cannot survive on a document that was written with George III in power in London with Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Membership fees apply after free trial. Cancel any time.
Can I be real for a second? That goal you have to exercise and eat better, you really can do it. But nobody is going to do it for you. And nobody has to, because you can do it if you have the right tools and a community that cares about helping you get results. And that's us, Beachbody. It's as convenient as your TV or laptop, but you need to decide that you're worth it. Let us help you succeed. Here's how. Go to Beachbody.com to claim your free membership and start feeling great.
Mobile phone companies say they offer home internet. But if their internet comes from a cell phone network, you should know. It's just phone internet, not home internet. Keep your home up to speed with Cox. Cox internet is faster and has more reliable download speeds than 5G home internet. Cox is the real home internet you're looking for. Based on Cox analysis of Ookla speed test intelligence data, Q3 2022, and Cox serviceable areas, visit cox.com/internet for details.